I don't think it's a technological challenge. I think we have a cultural, societal, psychological, communal challenge that we have to decide what is our attention worth? Where are we putting our attention to? When is this the best thing ever? And when is it the worst? And being able to identify those moments in between.
First of all, welcome. Thanks for coming in.
I'm happy to walk 4 minutes from my office to yours to get here.
Yeah, we made this one really easy for you. So Mitch, like starting from the top, you've talked on some of the biggest stages in the world. You've been a best-selling author. You've built and sold a very successful e-commerce company. You've kind of done a lot in your career, but I wanted to start with your roots. I wanted to start with the beginning. I believe your first gig was you were a music journalist. You interviewed Tommy Lee. I believe that was the first gig.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Dare we say you were a rock journalist.
Yeah, for sure. Music writer.
That's right. Then you even co-founded a music label, a hard rock label.
Yeah.
I know you're also a very big comic book fan.
Yeah, I am.
So you have this.
I have a lot of interests.
Yeah, you have a lot of interests. So my question for you about the roots part, like how your journey sort of evolved, is you clearly have this very eclectic interest in art and creativity. And then you've gone on to do all kinds of things on the business side and the marketing side. How and when did you decide to transition from the world of sort of, let's call it pure creativity, journalism, writing, into the world of business and marketing? And sort of, is there a connective thread that was there all along the way for you?
Yeah. In my second book, Control Alt Delete, I talk about the squiggly life. And the idea there is we have this conception that you go to school and in some way, shape, or form, either you or with the help of a guidance counselor, you choose some type of formal educational path. And the thought is you're going to go down that path and you'll graduate, you'll get a job in that world, you'll move forward in that world. You might become a partner in a law firm, or you might start your own law firm like you did. And that trajectory, if you think about it, seems that it goes from the bottom left to the top right, that it's very linear and moves in that direction. As you do better, you move higher and higher up. So when I look at people whose careers we truly admire, and it's not necessarily even from the tech space, what you see is that it's usually not that linear, that there was some type of change in education that they went into and studied something, but then went into a completely different direction and they tried this thing and it didn't work and that went here. You know, great example of that would be somebody who, I don't know if you know him, but Harley Finkelstein from Shopify is a great example of that. Mm-hmm. When I first met Harley and we became friends, I think he was just finishing up his law degree. Or no, sorry, he was doing online t-shirts at the time. But he studied law, went to practice a bit of law, realized it wasn't for him, had done DJing in school and had done some work with promotional items and things like that, and thought internet is kind of still relatively new from an e-commerce perspective. Why don't I start selling? He looked around and found this solution of this tool called Shopify that was really just a handful of very few people that were trying to sell snowboards that needed to optimize the software, because back then software wasn't cloud-based. It was really expensive. Mm-hmm. It was really challenging, and partnered up with them and then actually stopped selling his t-shirts and went to become one of the developers of this software because he believes so deeply in it, becomes Shopify. These are stories that we know, but we don't realize that it's actually a very squiggly path. It's like, I studied law, it didn't work out, I was selling this. So when I think about my path, it doesn't seem that extraordinary or different. And I don't think it was a creative to a business one, because even when I was writing and I was contributing to magazines, and this is a pre-internet world, I was still thinking about how would you build a business around this? What are the components that make this work? So when I transitioned, and I did it really quickly from being a writer to being a publisher and editor of a magazine, it was a lot of work because I had no experience doing it, but I had some connective tissue in terms of I had been asking a lot of questions about how do you make money in a magazine? Where does one print a magazine? How do you find photographers? How do you do layout? Because again, this was, you know, the earliest versions of the magazines I created. The scanners at the time were either industrial, which were untenable for someone just starting a magazine, or it was, in my case, those handheld Logitech scanners. And you created, like, we would take shoeboxes as guides because otherwise it would get squiggly and it wouldn't work. The entire output of it was so different. So the desire that I had was always around the world of media, entertainment, brands. When I was very young, I jokingly tell people, I love walking through shopping malls. I don't necessarily buy a lot. I'm not a massive consumer, but I love shopping. I don't necessarily love buying. Mm.
You're like my wife.
She doesn't like buying. She just likes shopping.
She likes shopping way more than she likes buying. Okay. So she just loves the experience of shopping.
Me too. And I'm always curious by what goes where and what looks like what and how does it change over the years. So when I look back on my career from writing to publishing magazines to being interested in the internet to working in internet-based businesses, there is a lot of connective tissue around media, advertising, communication, brand building. Mm. Those anchors are there from before day one. Even when I was a young kid trying to do, you know, magic parties as a magician, trying to do magic for kids parties, it wasn't necessarily the magic or the performance. It was probably more in the building of that type of business. Would people pay for this? That got me super interested. So for me, I always had interest in that. What I did realize in my path is that the traditional education system wasn't working for me. It might have been the school that I was at. It might have been the way in which I perceived education at that level. But once I started reading really on my own, and this, you know, it flies in the face. A lot of our peers will get their MBA or get their law degree and stop reading. It's like, okay, I'm done. I'm out now. I did all the reading I had to do.
That's when it should really start. I mean, once you go into practice, once you start practicing something, that's when you really need to kick up the education. But I agree. A lot of people follow that traditional model and they're not served very well by it, typically.
Yeah. And I don't know who said it, but I'm often quoted because I say it a lot, but I don't think it was my quote that I never let school get in the way of my education.
Right.
It's just a way to think.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things with me that are anti-establishment, I would say, too. There's a bit of that. Mm. I do like the irreverence. I do like a lot of things that people will dismiss or think it's for a certain generation versus another. Mm. And I think there's a lot of learning in paying attention to things like that. That's just my own perspective on it.
So that's probably why you were very interested in the internet from the beginning, right? And when you talk about that connective thread, I've always seen people in our generation, so let's call it Gen X, broadly speaking, people that are like in their 40s and 50s now, I've always seen us as kind of a bridge generation because we were fully formed adults before the internet sort of blew up. But at the same time, we kind of usually started our careers right around the time that the dot-com boom and the internet started really picking up. And we've really had a kind of a front row seat at the evolution of the internet. And certainly you did. I mean, your career literally tracks very, very heavily around that time, sure. Right? But I don't know sometimes if it's a gift or a curse, but it gave us this kind of sense of perspective of we have this like before and after, right? What life was before, we have these strong memories of life before the internet or without the internet. And then like, but at the same time, we're as immersed in the connected life as anybody else.
Yeah, there's a huge level, we use the word privilege a lot in our world now, in particular when it comes to race and gender and diversity. But there's also privilege in time of birth that we don't reflect a lot on. I would
generational make the argument, privilege almost.
Yeah, and so while we are digital immigrants and we're not digital natives, that is fact. Our generation and timing was still of the age where we are open to new and to exploring. And because you're not so set in the ways of the past at that age, you're open to how it innovates and changes. That was very fortuitous for Gen X, 100%. So when I saw the first commercialized web browser, meaning it became accessible to the everyday person, and I was one of the first, definitely here in Montreal, I was way too young to have access through McGill, but was going somehow through that online BBS modems. When I saw the first visual browser, it became very clear to me that this is going to be a much more powerful way to get content to a broader audience. Why? Because if you love music, you would typically go in, buy a magazine, pre-internet, read the whole thing cover to cover, go back into the store and realize there's no new issue. It's going to take another 3-4 weeks for that to happen. You would reread it and reread it and reread it. Suddenly, and I remember this really, really clearly, there was a site called AllMusic. And every day they would update it with 3 or 4 articles. I mean, imagine, like, you think about the real time of Twitter, but back then it was 3 or 4 articles. And to me, that was ground zero. I knew exactly at that point that, hold on a second, if I can get content from them, again, this is pre-blogging and the ability to self-publish, it was much more complex then. But if I can get new content from them daily, waiting a month is just, that gap of time, it's wild. And if you fast forward to when blogging came in, and I started doing that really early in the, you know, probably 2004, 2005, and I would look to the landscape and see someone like Seth Godin, who was one of the earlier bloggers and somebody I know, love, and trust. My whole thing there was, well, this even blows it up further. Why? Because Seth isn't writing a new book every month. You'd be lucky if you saw something new from him every couple of years. Suddenly, he's giving you that insight free every single day. That to me was, I just saw everything. It is your Neo in the Matrix, and you're watching everything fall down, and you realize, you know, what we had before that moment and after that moment, it's going to be cataclysmic. Right. So what is, you know, Kevin Kelly, who's one of the founders of Wired and is a very well-known futurist, he wrote this book called The Inevitable. And I didn't have a word for it until he came up with that word. But I look back and go, these were inevitables. They were things that I could directly look at and go, no chance we're not doing that. And what's interesting is you have a whole population pushing against it going, we don't need that. And so I lived through that for decades now. I lived through people saying, why? I remember people saying, why would I ever need a computer in my home? Why would I ever need a computer on my desk in my office? Why would I ever need a computer that I could take with me from one place to another? Why would I ever need a mobile phone? Why would I ever need email on my phone? Why would I ever buy something on the internet? I could go through month by month to even this moment in time where people will say, there's no way that AI will replace any type of work that I do. And as somebody who is very early into it, I can tell you that there's not a piece of work that I don't touch right now that AI isn't my co-pilot on. And I can viably see it replacing me if it gets an inkling better. So I see these things and I know. So when I made these work changes and jumps over the decades that I've done, they were things that I felt compelled to do because it seemed so obvious to me. You're telling me you're going to go down to a library or call someone or ask someone when you need any form of information when you can find it in a search engine. And people were very dismissive of it. In the early days of search, because I was there before Google, people would type in words like car. But I'm sitting there going, hey, when I'm writing an article on Motley Crue as an example, what year did Shout at the Devil come out? And how do you spell Nikki Sixx's name? What did you do in that moment in time? Even if you went to a library, they wouldn't have that current information. I would have to call record labels. They would then have biographies printed up Xerox that if you were smart enough to be even technically savvy to have a fax machine at home, they would send you. Otherwise, they would compile these bios and weekly I would go and pick them up and that would be the answer to my question. I would then file them. I had massive filing cabinets for all of these bands because I needed to know what year an album came out. How do you spell that? All of these things that you had no access to.
It almost becomes an extension of your brain.
Right.
Like the fact checking, the additional little pieces of information here and there.
We don't realize it. We take it for granted. And now in a world where you have digital natives and things like Google, we take these and it's on your phone. You know, we take it for granted. But as Gen Xers, we really remembered that we had to look for things in such a larger scale of complexity that it's almost unimaginable to someone who is a digital native. It's unimaginable.
It's very hard for us to like, you know, my son's a digital native, my daughter. It's very hard for us sometimes. Like I see how ingrained it is in their way of thinking. Like there is no world pre-internet for them,
right?
It just doesn't exist. They don't have that reference point. And so I wonder sometimes about nostalgia, you know, the people who are nostalgic of the pre-connected age, right? Yeah. And I know like your first book, Six Pixels of Separation, you cover the theme of connectedness and how much closer all these digital tools make us. And I know that you've done a lot of work on the business side of things, but you also clearly, you've delved very deeply into the broader sort of social dimension to this. And I always see you as an optimist, correct me if I'm wrong,
yeah,
as to the potential of this technology to make us more productive, make us better, connect us. But there's also another perspective. Maybe it's nostalgia. Maybe it's people just getting old. But a lot of people believe that technology actually isolates and separates us. So I'm going to give you a little quote. This fantastic psychology academic at MIT, Sherry Turkle, she wrote this book called Alone Together.
Sure, she's great. Yeah, she's been on my show.
She's fantastic. And so she writes this. Online, we fall prey to the illusion of companionship, gathering thousands of Twitter and Facebook friends and confusing tweets and wall posts with authentic communication. But this relentless connection leads to deep solitude. So if we zoom out of the sort of this insanely connected life, and on one end, it seems inevitable that it's only going to become more mediated by technology, more connected. I suppose the central question a lot of us have is, how much are these technologies connecting us? And how much are they separating us? Or maybe it's both at the same time.
Well, they're doing both at the same time. And I would never extract one quote from someone like Sherry Turkle and dismiss it. But it's easy to dismiss that quote because what you're not factoring in, and she talks a lot about this in her work, is the reality that it isn't binary. So it's not we're connected or not connected. It is what started the connection, how small was it, and how large were you able to expand it? So for every conversation we have about how it isolates us, makes us feel alone, contributes to our mental health, to eating disorders, to comparison, to FOMO, to whatever, this is true. I could give you probably 20,000 more arguments about how it's connected us. Think about in relation to someone who has some form of physical disability. And suddenly they're egalitarian in terms of being able to communicate and connect in some type of virtual world. It could be a social network. It could be even an online game. We can't dismiss that. That the privilege that we have of being more able-bodied is flattened. It's completely equalized through digital channels. I happen to run a private Facebook group for fiction, for nonfiction and business authors. And it's a small group. It's a couple hundred people. But I would make the argument that that has translated into so many what I would call protein-based engagements, meaning we meet in person. I'm traveling to a city. That author's based in the city. Had we not had this private group where we can help one another become better writers, better experience, and use it healthy, in a healthy manner, I would have never had those engagements. Think about dating apps. Who falls in love and gets married in this day and age without the help of a dating app? Because if you think about the world without dating apps, it's mind-blowing that what you're doing is predicating your actual future and love based off of probably a 2-kilometer radius and luck of walking into some space at the same time as someone else, where now you're expanding it to interests and beyond. Are there problems with online dating? Yeah, we have harassment. We have a ton of issues related to rape. And I mean, there's tons of problems with it.
So hookup culture, people who just stay sort of fixated on that phase.
Which might relate to things like people not getting as much married now or having as many kids. There's all sorts of things. But the point being is that it's ambiguous. It's ambiguous in the same way that fire is. Fire keeps us warm and has led to a mass amount of innovation. But at the same time, it can burn your house down. Is it extremely dangerous? So the platforms, technology has that ambiguity to it. There's no doubt. But for every negative, I could point to a positive. I could sit here and talk to you about how cancerful this technology current is because of how it addicts you, because of how unhealthy it is, because of how as Gen Xers, we remember episodic moments. You watch TV, it was a half hour, an hour, and then you went on to another activity or you watched something else. Now you can scroll aimlessly through TikTok and it never ends. You could lose 4 hours of your life without having any cognition of the physicalness of time because it never ends. You and I used to play video games on Atari or Coleco or Intellivision or whatever it was, Super NES. Those games ended. They had levels, they had bosses, and at the end you won and it was over. Games now never end. In fact, the engines are created to keep you there as much as possible. If you study the area, which I do a little bit, you know that they're not even competing with other media formats now. These technologies are competing with sleep. That's what they're trying to ultimately do. And they have these addictive things built into them, unhealthy. But again, for every story like that, you may be dismissing the person who's going to create the next great innovation because they met somebody through these connected channels. I have incredible business relationships over what's coming into 3 decades. So at least the earliest days of internet connectivity. And a lot of them were 100% digital or originated. They originated digitally and then evolved. Now, think about relationships like that, that you evolve beyond the digital tweet. Now think about how suddenly you've moved from the tweet to texting. So now I have people like a work wife or a work BFF that I see as often as possible, but more often than not, we are connected. Now there's the old Chris Rock joke about how it used to be that you went to work and that your spouse was at home and that person could have died in between that time, you'd never know. Now it's like you're working and in the relationship all the time because of texting. Is that good? Is that healthy? Does it help the relationship? Does it not? We have to be able to take the brilliant work of people like Sherry Turkle, the brilliant work of people like Johan Harry. There's David Sachs who talks about living a more analog life. These are great insights that we have to do and understand that, like everything else, balance. What is the balance? So if it's taking over your life or is it an activity? To me, that's the story. It's a story I try to teach my kids. It's the story that I speak to other parents about. And I'll tell you that when we talk about younger people in particular, the biggest thing I see is that they're modeling after their parents, that the kids aren't even close to being as bad as the parents are. The parents don't realize it. They're like, we're mature. We know what we're doing. But ultimately, it's their behavior that is causing the modeling that's pushing it forward. So, you know, a powerful story that I heard recently is a school was looking at digital usage in terms of their students. And what they realized is that in between classes, the biggest problem was parents texting the kids. Make sure you do this. Don't forget this. The digital helicopter parenting. So how do you want the school to move forward with a healthier attitude of activity-based using technology when you should in a world where the parents won't stop talking digitally to anybody? So these are the challenges that we have, but I don't think it's a technological challenge. I think we have a cultural, societal, psychological, communal challenge that we have to decide what is our attention worth? Where are we putting our attention to? When is this the best thing ever? And when is it the worst? And being able to identify those moments in between.
Yeah, I love the analogy with fire. And I think you're showing that perspective that without and with, and you sort of you were very aware and self-aware as all of these transformations were kind of being hoisted onto us. Okay, what's the boundary? And you mentioned, so fire.
But the thing with that is you're only as good as the worst person in your network. So if you've got a kid that has way too much screen time, it might be the kid's friends' parents that are the real problem. Because of what they're modeling and because of what this kid thinks, they're constantly pinging your kid in. And now your kid is trapped in that. And if your kid resists, we're not going to do this. We're not going to have that kid have a device. They're socially extracting themselves from a social circle that could be really precarious to their development and growth.
So you're very, very aware of the threats. That's something I see, like, right? Like, so nobody would argue that we were better off pre-fire. Like, nobody would make that argument, right? But at the same time, fire can burn down your house. So the key is, and you mentioned it, like health. So you mentioned the perspective of health, like doing it in a healthy way, doing it in a balanced way. And now you're giving this perspective on you're only as good as the worst person in your network, which is like, okay, so this is what I'm hearing. You correct me if I'm wrong. We should not approach it as shiny new object. Let's dive in blindly and just figure out later what happens. We should have a little bit of trepidation and a little bit of awareness as to, you know, the potential for good, the potential for bad. And then we need to sort of apprehend these technologies from a broader human perspective and also be very aware, because I don't know how many people would worded so strongly, like you're only as good as, like, the worst person in your network can actually cause a lot of damage.
100%.
So it's like, how do we go about drawing those boundaries in a sort of in a mature way and not fall prey to shiny new object syndrome of we just sort of get addicted with playing with a new toy?
I don't see it in that framework. The framework that I would see it in is, one, if you have any form of literacy in this technology, you will typically fall into that early adopter mode. So playing with it, tinkering with it, trying it, it's healthy because you have a level of education, understanding, impact that makes you somewhat skeptical while being optimistic about it at the same time. So I've tried a lot of things over the years that have fallen, you know, face first into the digital dust that I don't even necessarily miss because you realize in that, that it never really had its place. So let's look at early adopters and say, okay, we're going to place hold them over here. In the middle of that, you have what I called real consumer behavior. So what I'm really ultimately looking for is not the early adopters and the tinkerers and people willing to try it. I'm looking for the moment in time where it has fundamentally changed how somebody lives and or buys. So I'll give you a great example of this. You and I used to go out and buy media. You bought a CD, you bought a book, you bought a movie, you had your collection, you'd proudly display it in your living room. That's what we did. And you snap your fingers and you're in a world of Netflix and Apple Music and Disney Plus and streaming services. So most people would look at that and go, wow, streaming services are really interesting. I go, they are. And what makes it most powerful is people went from buying a thing to paying a monthly fee to have access to a library or everything. That's a big shift in technology. Then if I can take that shift and apply it to every business, B2B, B2C, small, medium, large. So here we are in your office, you're running a law firm. One of the things people who call you will ask for an opinion on something. You will then have people scramble and put together some piece of thinking. What if that information is in some type of database that you're actually pulling it from, and you made that directly accessible to your customers, and you charge them a monthly premium for them to be able to self-serve into that information? So you're now alleviating this hustle, this back and forth, this one-to-one. You're letting them service it, and by finding some of these answers, that's making them want to engage you more because, wow, you're making me smarter. It's faster to do. That becomes a differentiator between you and the competitor down the hall. Mm-hmm. What's amazing about that is you've basically Netflixed an aspect of your business because we know that the consumer's behavior desire to do that has changed. So I'm swiping left or right for, I'm talking a lot about dating. My wife doesn't let me date. I should just be really clear about that. But you use something like, you know, you're swiping left or right. It's the same idea as I push a button and a car arrives or food arrives or flowers arrive. So that's a consumer behavior that has changed. How we buy, how we do things. And then the third area of that is the laggards, which are the people who try to get to it way too late. And now suddenly what they're doing is their competition is multiplied. Because before that, they were competing with who was in their competitive landscape, but now they're also competing with the digitizations of it. So look at things like the taxi business and how slow they were to adapt to just saying, hey, if we put an app out that just basically lets people know that the cab is coming and where it is, why would people use Uber? And the question may be price, it may be cleaner, whatever it might be. But is that enough of a differentiator to change the landscape? So they allowed ride sharing to change the story for a myriad of reasons. But then they quickly caught up. So they played that game, and in theory, it did work for them because you have things like contractor issues. You have things like just pricing in general, and cabs are actually in many areas like here where we live in Montreal, cabs are way cheaper than Uber is right now. So it can work and not, but it could have destroyed them too. So that laggard game is a very dangerous one to play. I like the middle one. I like the one where you are astute enough to see this behavior, this technology has changed how people buy. How does that impact my business? So, you know, we could talk really specifically about your industry, which I don't know much about, but you look at things like NFTs and non-fungible tokens. So now we have a world where people are buying digital assets based off of this idea of scarcity, whereas before all we had was abundance. Mm-hmm. And now you're starting to see things like smart contracts. Like if I do something with you here at Pinto Legal, maybe you will NFT or tokenize that thing. And so I don't have to deal with the problems later proving to a judge that this is the latest copy, that it's mine. We see this a lot in reconciliation of wills, for example. Prove that there's no other wills out there. Well, if I've NFT'd or tokenized this will, it's very apparent to everybody where this final digital piece of code went to. So this is really transformative. Mm-hmm. Some people go, oh, you know, NFTs and like Bored Apes, it's like the world's imploded. I'm like, oh, no. All it did was validate that people will do this. They will have a digital wallet. They might use cryptocurrency, but more importantly, they're interested in the idea of a smart contract, meaning a digital file that has some piece of technology attached to it that says this is one of or one of a series of.
Very powerful. We've done a lot of thinking around this issue of NFTs, smart contracts. I believe so. This is where the crux of the matter in our industry. Crux of the matter is there are some simple contracts that are really like, you deliver X, I will deliver Y in terms of payment, okay? That smart contracts would be fantastic for, because it reduces. Yeah. So it's really all about risk and uncertainty, managing risk, uncertainty, and cost. Really, the fundamentals of the legal system are always about risk and uncertainty. There are, however, situations that are so complex inherently, okay? You can have a 40-page contract. First of all, the contract itself creates some uncertainty.
For sure.
Because of the ambiguities and clause
3.4. It's language, it's not binary.
Language. Yeah. It's language. And so—
And it's interpretation.
That's right. And then there are contracts that try to predict the future. So what you're going to do, what I'm going to do. And then the better contracts are dynamic contracts. If this happens, this will be the outcome. If this happens, this over there will be the outcome. Those are the better contracts. But that requires a lot of finagling and a lot of—
Right. And a lot of unknowns, I'm sure, ultimately.
A lot of unknowns.
How much can you figure out?
A lot of unknowns. So when a dispute arises, okay, this is really the issue when it comes to smart contracts in our industry, particularly when something happens, the question is, how is the uncertainty of this situation going to be adjudicated and ascertained, right? And you will find, so if you could wave a magic wand and say, well, you know, when there's a legal dispute, you just refer to the smart contract rules and it'll just adjudicate. You will find that a lot of people are not comfortable with the idea that we will have foreseen all of the issues that will emerge.
Yeah, I would argue that that is also completely irrelevant. And the bigger problem isn't that. The macro problem that you're actually talking about is the fact that if you have a contract that was built in some form of decentralized way, mm-hmm. the minute you bring it into a centralized system, it collapses, period. Mm-hmm. That's the actual bigger issue, is the fact that you're not looking at the contract as the form of adjudication. The problem with having this decentralized contract is that if it never needs to be enforced, it will only be enforced in a centralized environment. Mm. So the only way this works is if you have a decentralized judiciary system, which we don't have, clearly. No. This is what we're dealing with cryptocurrency and crypto winter. It's the fact that anytime we talk about a problem with it, we have to move it from decentralized to centralized, and it collapses. And then the response becomes, well, then, what's the point? Mm. How is it truly going to live in the decentralized world? So what I think will happen is you're going to have two parallel lines. You're going to have people within the legal system, let's say, deciding that they're completely comfortable working in a decentralized way. What would that look like? Perhaps instead of having a judge in a physical location based off of where the actual contract was executed, I'm saying it's decentralized, and now what I'm using is the network, the nodes, to actually decide the verdict.
Yeah.
You're going to have them. So it's very
that takes a high level of trust. Yeah, it's exactly ambiguous. It's like you said before about the ambiguity. That requires a level of trust in technology that a lot of people don't have. Because I'll tell you the benefits—
And you don't need everybody to have it. Look at crypto.
Exactly.
Like most people don't have a digital wallet. They'd never be— And by the way, that is the FTX problem.
Yeah.
Is people wanted to have the benefit of crypto, but they didn't want the full benefit of it, which was the fact that it's decentralized. So you put it into a centralized system, which then becomes the victim of people's greed and the system. And when it collapses, you look at each other and go, well, what happened? I'm simplifying it.
Of course.
But it's true.
No, but it's absolutely true what you're saying, because there are many uses. So there are many types of contracts, many types of situations that would, without a doubt, be improved tremendously with the use of a decentralized system, with NFTs, and with through smart contracts, without a doubt. Now, the question is, when we talk about legal and contracts, those are very elastic terms. Yeah. And we're talking about very, very different types of situations. The benefit of a centralized system, in theory, because it absolutely is much more susceptible to corruption and to sort of hidden agendas.
Or an individual's moment in time.
Yeah, that's right.
You walk in, right? Look, we've had issues in, you know, dealing with our accounting, our legal. I mean, everyone has these issues as you grow and build a business over the amount of time. No one is you know, unscathed from anything like that. And when you speak to professionals, whether they're lawyers or accountants, they'll say the same thing. It's 100% in your favor. It just depends on how the judge is feeling that day.
That's absolutely true.
And so how flawed of a system is that?
Well, I mean, we see with statistics, for instance, when the local football team loses the previous weekend, the judge hands out harsher sentences. Or when the temperature is warmer that day, they hand out harsher sentences. I actually wrote an article about this in The Atlantic, and I have a Supreme Court judge from Ohio that we're interviewing next week who reached out to me on LinkedIn and said, Fred, this is my battle. Like, I've been fighting this. The wrongful convictions that you see in the legal system are out of control. Statistics are telling us how biased judges are. They make decisions based on things that are completely irrelevant. that are not part of the legal system. And so all of this, these are all the problems, the known problems of the centralized system. The advantage in theory, and it's a theoretical advantage, but when you see it in practice, it does play out in the real world, is that when you have a situation that emerges that is unforeseen, and it's a little bit more complex than, you know, Fred hired Mitch and he's not paying Mitch, and so now we have this issue. It's a little bit more complex than that. There's an uncertainty involved. The idea is you're going to have a human being who is a representative of the legal community that is the trustee of certain values, values of integrity, values of honesty, values of, you know, respecting a contract, what that means. And this person is going to look at the situation, and when the rules are insufficient to sort of get to an outcome, this individual is going to think about it from a holistic human perspective and is going to make a fair and just decision. This is an ideal. It does not always play out that way. It very often does not play out that way because you go in front of a judge, sometimes they're exhausted, they're dealing with 18 cases that day, they're human factors. But in theory, a centralized system is meant to be the trustee, the fiduciary of certain values.
Sure.
And you want to trust that, but there are, it turns into a monster.
Well, look, you graduate top of your class, you build a very successful practice, and in all of this, last week you became a junkie. Mm. So all the things you're talking about go by the wayside because every decision you're making now isn't focused 100% the way it was 24 hours before. Think about when we're talking about things like AI. AI in diagnosing things like cancer. What we're seeing is that when we feed this information into these large language models or some type of technology that's looking at much larger data sets that can scan it in a way in which a human being can't, we're seeing results. Should we have perhaps somebody, maybe an individual, maybe a panel, maybe another form of AI, on top of that reviewing it to get it closer to be 100% certainty or whatever it might be? I'm just saying that I believe the day and age in which you went to a store and bought a magazine and then had things like a Twitter feed in relation to that type of content has to be coming for everybody's work. Mm. So the individual sitting behind the desk thinking and working to the best benefit of their knowledge and their skill is probably going to be a multiple less in a world where these large language models or AI modeling can actually not only replicate you and how you judge or make your calls, but also take that into consideration from thousands of other people in your profession. I just don't want to dismiss that. I don't want to be the person sitting across from you saying, yes, it can do this, but it can never do that. Mm-hmm. I have just seen enough in my short lifetime to see any time that's been said to be completely false. And the reason is, I don't look at it as an absolutist. I don't go, it's either this or that. One of the lines I wrote about, long before the first book, Six Pixels of Separation, but in my blog and in my articles was, everything is with, not instead of. Mm. I think people's mindset is always instead of, it's going to replace. Mm. What if it's just with? What if it's just with, and suddenly it's we made hard. Fred a super lawyer. Mm. You have, because right now I can tell you on the creative side of content creation, whether it's writing, podcasting, making decisions upon investing, getting ready for a meeting, coming up with ideas for the nonprofit work I'm doing, that when I use AI, it gives me a superpower. Hmm. Now, I know right now it's a superpower because not everybody else is using it, but I'm convinced that when it starts proliferating to the masses and we have that tipping point, like we talked about earlier in the middle, consumer behavior, it's going to change everything. And will it be bad? It's going to be terrible. Mm. Will it be great? It's going to be amazing. 100%.
I love that paradox. But it's amazing because you really see it as a tool. So, and I've had this discussion with a lot of, particularly in my industry, and telling them, look, if we had access to AI, if we had in our profession, it would give us some abilities that we don't have in terms of information processing, in terms of knowing how judges actually make decisions, not the theory of the law, the three
prongs. Well, just even, like you said, in murder, you've got this blood sample, you've got eyewitnesses. Yeah. I just had an incident recently. I can't remember where it was, but it was something around, did you speak to this person about that? And I could have sworn to you that I did. And it turns out I did not. Mm. And it made me realize how many people might be in jail because someone said, that's exactly who I saw. But in turn, they believe it because of whatever conversations or thing in time has given them this perception. And we see this all the time with eyewitnesses as well. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about things like, should there be cameras everywhere? What are the privacy implications? What about using AI for facial recognition? And all of these things that can move us to very dark places, we could also see that they could move us to very enlightened places.
Absolutely.
Where criminals who are in jail right now are absolutely not criminals and are wrongly accused of crimes. Blood, you know, you might have somebody working in the lab who's just tired that day, who made a mistake, who slipped up. It's not their fault. We shouldn't put them in jail. They made a vocational error. Mm. But this person is doing 20 years to life on nothing else.
I couldn't agree more strongly, because we always take our current reference point as the sort of absolute or as the peak of, and then, the threats. But it's like self-driving cars, right? What if they can slash car accidents by 80%?
100%.
So some people are going to point to,
it killed somebody last week.
Yeah, but what about all the people
How many people did we kill last week?
Yeah. How many people did we kill? Exactly.
I got to tell you a funny story about self-driving cars. So, look, I've had a very fun career. And I say that because when I think about the situations I find myself in, I can remove myself from that situation and go, this is fun. One of those situations happened over a decade ago. I was at an event for Google in Arizona somewhere. And as part of the event, they were taking people on self-driving cars, first time on public roads with people who are non-Googlers. So you would sign up for this thing. There was basically two or four people in the car. And in the front seat, there were two Googlers, one in the driver's seat, another one with a laptop plugged in, whatever the early days of the self-driving technology was. And I signed me up. Let's do this. I got to one is to just be that one of those people. To be the first non-Googler in a self-driving vehicle felt like that's something I would do. Get into the car.
You were an early adopter in that.
Yeah, for sure. I was excited to try too. Yeah. I mean, I know they're not going to take us into, you know, crazy traffic or problems. They probably cased out this, all that stuff. Get into the car and they start explaining what the technology is, because your instinct would be, well, it's Google Maps or it's Waze, which Google owns. No, they actually built an entirely different system for this navigation and what it does. And they start pointing out how it's noticing objects that weren't there or where it's noticing them. And then it's showing you how far out this system is grabbing in information. We're talking miles and or kilometers out. And is it a fun drive? It's not like a fun drive. It's not a great... But it is driving in a very safe way, to the point where when the car came back to the hotel and parked, I thought to myself, my first reaction was, if I could never get into the car with another human being driving again, I would.
Wow.
Only because the information I saw it gathering was staggering to me. That's something that I know I'm not paying attention
to.
No
human being has the ability. You didn't sleep well last night, right?
But
all of a sudden,
the world isn't perfect. And so if a squirrel pops out, might that create a swerve? If the car has to decide that it's between a kid and an old person, it's going to hit somebody, who does it hit? Like all of the other issues that come into it, the conversations around what are our values, what do we want it to do, become the question mark. And again, just coming back from an automotive event that I spoke at, one of the other keynote speakers was from the U.S. Highway Safety Institute or whatever, and was very vocal in the fact that we are still a long ways away from being away from fully automated systems because of the issues. Fine. But I still look at the nascent technology and think, no human is paying that. It never gets tired. It never gets sleepy. Its eyes, how they see, never changes. I don't know about you. I'm getting older. Yeah. Every time I go see the eye doctor, I'm like, what? I can't see that much.
Yeah.
We don't really, and people do not go to the eye doctor.
And we're okay. And just driving. We've gotten used to human beings driving cars. We've gotten used to this number of car accidents.
They're older. They're slower. They're drinking. We're in a world of legalized pot. Maybe they're a little high. Mm-hmm. The reactions are a little slower. Maybe there's more time. Like all of these factors are gone when you do that. Now imagine if all these cars are also connected to one another. Mm-hmm. So they're daisy chained. They're daisy chained technologically. I know how far I am from you. I know what you've done. I actually know the problems that your car might have. You might be at 40% brake capacity. What if you knew the car in front of you had 5% brakes left?
Yeah. So I learned about this actually in one of your blog posts. You mentioned Herzog Werner's Lo and Behold.
Yeah.
His beautiful technology documentary. And one of the things they were looking at was this technology precisely where the information, the data from all the cars gets shared. So now
network. It's
not network effect. So it's not one individual learning and becoming a better driver. It's the entire network across millions and millions of drivers becoming safer and safer as you go.
And you have a million of people now who don't know how to drive, who are driving Teslas, yeah, who are feeding information that will make the automation better because they're seeing at scale how human nature is. How heavy are you on these regenerative brakes? What are you like on a turn? What are you like on a highway? Yeah. So the speed limit here is 70 kilometers an hour on one of the expressways. People are going 120. Like, that's information where the car can throttle you to, let's say, even 80 or 90. Mm. Even though you're over the speed limit, you're probably making you 30 to 40% safer. Like, there's all these little things that we have to understand that we can't even, the things that I'm saying are probably even wrong. It's probably able to do things at scale that we can't even comprehend. Mm. Our ability to not be able to comprehend it is the thing that holds us back. Mm. Because we think in our box, in our finite way, with our very limited information, in a very limited cognitive system that we've had for billions of years that has hardly evolved into systems that are growing at exponential speed, especially when we talk about things like AI right now. I have to be able to have the cognitive dissonance to understand that I probably don't understand much in relation to a supercomputer. So even one of the challenges we hear now in AI is, this is a big problem. We've got engineers who don't know how the AI is thinking. And my answer back is, no kidding. How would you expect a limitation of a human organic brain to understand what's happening in a non-organic, exponentially understanding information system that is taking in billions and billions of inputs every single second?
So I have a question with you on that point, because it's clearly, like, anything that's analytical, anything that's like taking in information, computing it, I mean, we can't get it. The idea of competing, it's obsolete, doesn't make any sense. However, in a human context, and I know you're a writer, you write for other human beings, right? So it's, the way I see it is human, technology, human, right? At the end of the day, it's a human being receiving this information, right? So if you want to create value, let's say in a literary space, or like for a motion picture, or in the artistic realm, like composing a song, ultimately you're creating value for a human being, right? Do you think that there's an edge to HI, so human intelligence? So there are computational type challenges that are, let's say, the technology can already do exponentially better than any human being ever has, without a doubt. But then understanding the predicament of a human being from, let's call it, just to use some terms that are problematic, we can from an emotional perspective, or from a life perspective, or from a narrative perspective. Do you think that all of those human perspectives can ultimately be broken down into data that computers can understand better than us? Or is the fact of being a native human give you the ability to communicate with another human in a way that's more effective?
We want to believe that.
Okay.
Because we want to control. Okay. So one is, if we alleviate this notion that we can't control anything, it changes your dynamic. But there's one word that I would use to describe what you're actually saying. Can a computer replicate when a human does something that is surprising? It's really the word surprising that you're talking about. And so the answer to that question is, you listen to a form of music, which is 7 notes, that, or 26 notes if you count flats and minors and whatever, or whatever the number might be. And how is it that you can have the Beatles use the same 7 notes as the Rolling Stones or Post Malone, and the result is so different? And the answer is, because of influence and who we are and culture, you create a surprising result based off of who you are as an individual. The way I write a word is not the way Tom Peters would write a word or Whitney Johnson would write a word. It's just, that's what human beings are. We create these surprising moments.
Yeah.
Now, if you take Google as an example, that has been in the large language model business for a long time with AI. People think, oh, they're so far behind because of ChatGPT and OpenAI. They've been in AI for a long time. There was a documentary on this game, Go, which is a very complex game, board game, similar to chess, but apparently much harder and impossible to play. Now, they've proven technologically that they could use an AI to beat a human in this game, thinking it's impossible because the myriad of variations in how to win. When the AI system won, what happened was it did a bunch of plays that no human had ever done.
Yeah.
I could transcribe that easily and say it was surprising. Mm-hmm. So the answer is, can AI do something surprising? Now down to market of one, Mitch Joel. My experience is, when I use ChatGPT and I ask it for things like, take this article and create a headline for me, create 10 of them, I am often very surprised by the result, in a sometimes negative, but more often than not, positive. And I will use certain aspects of it because I don't think I would have thought of it that way because of where I was in the creation of the content. Right. So when we ask that question, I believe the answer is yes, because I have seen proof in multiple ways, not just me, but in research as well, that these systems can do things that are surprising and in the same way, interesting to a human being.
Oh, okay, so that's the second part, because yes, there's a lot of literature around the violation of expectation is what all great art does. Creates an expectation and then violates it. But the second piece to it is that it violates it in a manner that is understandable by a human being in their current cultural, emotional, psychological context. And that's the part that I'm asking myself, because I've also played a lot with ChatGPT. Has it come up with decent articles, blog posts that, you know, the average...
Don't need it to. Okay. I need it to work as a junior copywriter.
Got it.
I need as it to tool. Work as a brainstorming partner. It is giving me a superpower. I'll give you a more relatable example, because AI is somewhat obscure to most people. Music, auto-tune. Mm-hmm. Do you like auto-tune? Do I like auto-tune? Yeah. So when auto-tune is used at scale, people hear that, whatever that thing is. So what's interesting about that is you now have artists who sing with the timbre of auto-tune, because that's what they've heard so much over their career. So imagine you're not replicating an artist, you're replicating a sound that a technology generated.
Yes.
That's the extreme side. On the non-extreme side, there are tons of instances where you've either been live at a concert or listened to an album that has moved you to tears, that auto-tune was used in some level of context that is subtle and nuanced that you would have never have known, that to get the artist to hit that specific tone would have been physically impossible.
Very true.
There are a ton of producers right now who cannot listen to music from the 60s and 70s because all they hear are the mistakes. It is those mistakes that made it so beautiful to our tone and ear. But because of the advent of technology and how we produce, record, and even create music, we have become accustomed to the complete cyborg of what music is. So people think, oh, you could never do that in music and art. I'm like, you are already a victim and passionate about the artists that do it. Like I said, the ones that do it at scale, it's very overt. But the subtleness of it, where you're taking a singer who is a half a tone off here, a quarter of a tone there, and making it so that that harmony hits you right in the heart, you don't even know it's being used.
That's very true.
So the truth is, we see that in creativity all of the time. We don't know how many artists are currently, let's say you're a painter, how many of them use a form of technology or AI to find the perfect tone color? 30% green, 20% yellow, 5% red. It could only be created by a technology that then they take, create the mixture, and then apply it to a painting that strikes you down when you see it. Mm. We don't even know. And that's the part that I think people struggle with, this binary of, well, I see this new technology, so I'll freak out. But that technology or type of technology that has been manipulating or used to augment has been here for decades already.
Yeah, so it's a great way to look at it, because it's always what I reply to people that talk about this replacement model or it's technology versus human. No, it's human plus technology.
Everything is with, not instead of, 100%.
Right. Versus for human now. Without technology, right? Just like eyeglasses, like it's us with the eyeglasses versus us without the eyeglasses. Which one is better?
But it might get to the point where it does replace. Mm-hmm. And in that instance, we might want it to. So imagine a world right now where the system really understands how much money you have in, how much goes to taxes, how much, well, we actually have that system. So people freak out when they're like a digital currency. Like, look at your bank account. It's zeros and ones. Your employer literally doesn't even pay you with cash.
Yeah.
If you went to the bank and said, I need that money, they'd need 48 hours to produce that cash for you. Okay. So we know that and we see that. Now imagine if you had a technology that's analyzing your entire life and your usage that you've opted into, that you control this data. It sits in some type of blockchain, digital wallet, whatever you want to call it. Now it's time to vote. And you don't know how to vote. Who are these people? There's five people sitting up at the Westmount Public Library that you're meeting. I don't know. I mean, I might have a lean towards a certain party, but, you know, the individual. Now imagine if this AI, this thing existed that's looking at all of your values, everything they've said and done, and comes back and tells you, this is who you should vote for. You're like, oh man, would I trust that? I would trust it more than I trust me, because it's providing me a level of information that I can't physically as a human being reflect on. But the idea that you might have a digital component of you, an AI of you that is autonomously making decisions like who you vote for right now sounds insane. Mm. But all you're doing is scaling out from where you currently are, which is your money doesn't exist. It's a zero and a one.
It would be very interesting at the very least to have that information to be able to consider it.
So then it would be a with, and then as you trusted it, it might become the replacement. And by the way, imagine what would happen in politics if we had double the amount of people actually voting. Now imagine if you had double the amount of people actually voting really based off of their values and who they are in relation to how it relates to the person running for office. I mean, this is information you and I can't physically capture.
It's very interesting. This example makes me think of, there's a book called Super Forecasters. I forget the name.
Great book, yeah.
Yeah, I forget the name. I believe it was Ted Lee who wrote that book. I'm not sure, but they spoke about, they compared the diagnoses of experts, like doctors, okay, in the medical space, with the diagnoses made by a simplified model of those very same doctors. And they found out that the diagnoses of the model of the doctor, so it's a simplified, it's less than, right, from a human perspective, were more accurate than the diagnoses of the actual doctor.
Yeah, and then we have the variance of, you know, it's a plus 10, well, what happens in that? And one of the things I think is really happening right now with automated cars is not the fact that they may not be ready for prime time, but liability. I mean, I think that there's a lot of inter discussions from insurance companies saying, so then how do we insure Fred? Like, how do we insure Fred if the autonomous vehicle is driving? And then who do we blame if there's a problem?
Yeah.
Is it Fred?
Yeah.
Is it the car? Is it the make of the car? Is it the car manufacturer? So now if you have insurance professionals trying to figure out where blame goes, in a model that is completely different from, I could see why things like that might get held up in a centralized system.
Yeah, the actuaries at the insurance
companies. The actuaries, companies, yeah, exactly.
They will figure this out quicker than everybody.
Or the AI versions of the actuaries.
That's right. That's right, even better. Yeah. I want to make sure I talk a little bit about connecting brands with people, because you've done a lot of work in this area, and you've helped brands and consumers connect professionally for decades. And you've been an advocate that this can be done authentically. You've also pushed back against the notion that there's anything wrong with commerciality, with the fact that people are using these connective tools to, gain a competitive advantage, to grow their businesses. So how should businesses approach this extreme level of connectedness that we have today? So because I talk to a lot of business owners, and a lot of people struggle against it. You have this kind of maximalist version, like Gary Vee style, like post every day, like every business needs to become a media company.
Sure.
Publish, and just get out there. And you have a lot of people that want to be purists in some way. They're like, let me just focus on my product and focus on my customers. And all of that is just like exhausting. And I just don't even know where to start. Are there different, like, valid approaches to this challenge? And what are some important questions or touchstones that everybody should be asking themselves or considering?
I think the idea that someone like Gary Vaynerchuk puts out into the world has merits. And again, I think it can be ambiguous. At scale, we could look and go, hustle culture might be really unhealthy to a better balanced wellness. We could say, hey, if you hustle like that, you could have a level of success that's unattainable if you didn't do that. So I don't want to say the jury's out on that. I think it is a philosophical thought about how hard should we be spending our time at work. So let's put that aside as a macro idea. Are you a part of hustle culture, or do you push back against the idea of hustle culture, which are fair arguments across the board? And I can vacillate between the two personally, 100%. Now, in a world where any business grows by how they grow their customer base, and now you're no longer in a world where you fundamentally have to pay for access to the audience and that attention, advertising and marketing, you can win that in a bit of a different way now by creating valuable human-based content. I like that. I mean, I've always liked that. I'm a writer, so I would prefer that you bought the magazines for the articles and not the ads. But in a world of magazines like Vogue or fashion-based magazines, you buy them for the ads, and the content is a supplement to it. So, and there's stuff in the middle. There's a lot of stuff in the middle in relation to like travel magazines or health and athletic magazines. So it takes all kinds. There's not a one or the other. What I think came forward in the early days of digital content is this idea that content is media. So right now, we're doing this. Is this a valuable use of your bellable hours, Fred Pinto, and growing your law firm? And the answer is, this might be the differentiator between you and a lawyer who's two or three floors down in the same building. I don't know. What's going to make it resonate is whether or not an audience cares and wants to be a part of this and wants to come on this journey with you. And I can't speak to that. I mean, I really can't. Do I believe that the internet, and in particular social media, brought forward this idea of real human beings having real interactions with other human beings through the power of media? Yeah, I'm all in on that. I'm all in on that because not just only did it work for us to build a digital agency and build a platform and then do all the things that led to where I am now with ThinkersOne and all the work that I'm doing. It did 100, and it continues to do that. There's no doubt. But I also am able to recognize, as someone who spends a lot of time both creating media and studying it, that it's not easy, that it's not an either or. For some businesses, it's just much easier to pay for that access to the audience or to attention. For others, in my case, I like working harder only because I really enjoy creating content. Most of the time, I'm on the other side of the microphone. I'm the one having the conversation. So why am I giving people like Dan Pink or Whitney Johnson airtime? Because their work has inspired me. I have questions about it. I can now corner them for an hour, spend time with them. And the secret head fake of it is I'll publish it so other people can listen to it. But really, it's the most selfish act of content creation that I do. When I'm writing articles, what I'm really doing is letting the gasket open up. I'm mad. I read something that someone said. I'm like, that is absolutely false, untrue, or untrue in my realm of thought. Well, now I can put that thought into ideas and I can publish it out and see if my thought has more resonance than theirs. What's the strategic byproduct of it is it might have a similar result to advertising. That by creating this piece of content, it hits a certain audience that says, I'm aligned with that. We should hire Mitch to speak at our event. Back when I had an agency, we should work with Mitch's team to do our advertising and marketing. Or now, you know, we should go to ThinkersOne and find other thinkers like Mitch so we could bring that type of smart content into the business that we do every single day. For me, that's been a very successful model, but it's not easy to do what I do, and I'm not trying to inflate my own tires. I just spent a lot of time since the late 80s creating thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of content, and I just happened to hit a privileged moment in time where new people were coming in to try and do it, and I had a lot of years, a lot of tread on my tires over them. So I had a way to have a more unique voice or perspective because I had done radio and a ton of articles and a million interviews. So even now when people, you know, what makes your show interesting? I did thousands of interviews before I even had a podcast, which has been running for almost two decades at this point. So the answer is, yeah, man, it really depends. It really depends on the person. What is the type of content that you could not stop doing? What makes you passionate about doing it? If nobody was paying attention to it, would you still do it? Mm-hmm. See, I'm in a position where the stuff that I create, I can't stop doing. So if they shut down the internet, it would just be in a journal somewhere, mm-hmm. or it would be on a cassette somewhere, that conversation. I wouldn't stop doing it because it helps me grow. My thought is if it's helping me to grow, there's probably someone else out there in this world that it'll help for them to grow professionally. And if it helps them, perhaps that is a customer.
So I love how you don't generalize based on your particular experience, right? Like you're not saying this is what you should do. You're saying that it's highly case specific.
Yeah.
It sort of draws down on like, what is your unique experience? What things are you genuinely passionate about that you're going to keep doing anyway? And then can you get an audience to care about that? So it's those particulars.
The biggest mistake we make, and it's the theme of every part of this conversation, is everybody is a market of one. I would never do that. My wife would never do that. My boyfriend would never do that. My partner would never do that. My friends would never do that. Nobody does that in my community. You and I right now are recording this in a very affluent community that is approximately 4 kilometers in size with a population under 20,000 people. And if you drive up and down the streets in this community right now on the day we're recording this, it's dead quiet out there because these people are in Barbados and Mexico and up north skiing and doing a million things. You and I are still working here. But if you take and go 1 kilometer east, west, north, or south of here, it's busy because these people can't necessarily afford to go to Barbados for 2 weeks during March break when we're recording this, yeah. Right? And so if your perspective is, well, everybody is in Barbados right now, you're living in a really skewed world. Mm. So that's why I'm always able to zoom out and go, what is this? And who is the audience? And by the way, the beauty of thinking like that also, it absolves you of geography and physicality of why you're creating this. So my biggest challenge when I started off in the business was to try to not be Canadian because Canada's a smaller market. From the way I speak to the way I interview to the way I write. I don't write with my U's in the word color as an example. I try to watch words like university versus college, which are more Canadian or US colloquialisms. Why do I do that? Because I know that the US is a bigger market. When I transferred into digital, I did the same thing. So when people would say, where are you? I'd say, oh, I'm based in Montreal. They would be shocked. Not in a bad way, just the assumption is.
Yeah, North Pole.
And I created it because I believe there's a larger discernible market than the geography of where we live, the city, the state, the province, the country. And if you can think in a truly connected way, which is the internet, it's a global platform, then you start thinking, well, how do we take the content of this podcast and translate it to 50 other languages or 10 other geographies? So when you see people like Gary Vee, what I think he's doing so strategically, which I don't do, so this is a, you know, don't do as I say, just or sorry, do as I say, not as I do, is he's translating all of this content and making it, so his discernible market is going to scale exponentially versus someone like you and I, just if he just does that. I like that thinking, whether you like the values, the content or not, it's almost irrelevant. It's the thinking that I use digital for as my baseline. So think about one quick example would be retail. So here we are in a kind of retail area. Mm-hmm. So now you're opening up a store and you're hoping that enough people walk by or hear about it in this town of X million of people that will walk into that area when you are open to do it. Or would you like to sell the exact same product 24/7 to anybody in the world? That's what e-commerce is. So how is it we have a world where people still want to open that physical store in a place where you can build that tiny bookstore that you want to build and have it have a global audience? Now, what's going to make it powerful? It's going to be the culture of it, digitally or physical. What type of content are you creating? What type of conversations? What makes people want to shop at yours to buy books from you versus a Barnes & Nobles or another independent retailer? That's what you build with culture. And culture comes from our media. Now, anybody can create media, text, images, audio, video, short form, long form, live, pre-recorded, with essentially a free distribution network. That's powerful.
It's very powerful. And in terms of that, I also wanted to touch on the theme of reinvention or rebooting that you've touched a lot in your career. And it's an interesting segue because we talk about the sort of like overall human experience that you're trying to create, right? Physical, digital. It's the and perspective, right? Not the or perspective.
One thing with, the with versus instead of. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. That's really one of the threads that I take out of this conversation is, and it's hard to think that way in terms of additive, right? Sure. We've got to combine perspectives, and we're just not wired. It's easier for us to just create these with or without these absolutist perspectives, but our insight's going to be very limited if we do that. So in your second book, Control, All, Delete, you explore the theme of reinvention and you give the example of Hernan Cortez, burn your boats.
It's a bad example now.
but it's an example that a lot of people talk about and a lot of people use that phrase, that metaphor of burning your boats, meaning that, you know, like you don't have a fallback position. Like you're moving forward, you're reinventing yourself. And you kind of developed the idea of the reboot as a modernization of Cortez. And it's about, you know,
didn't stand up that right. Cortez was a really bad guy. Colonialism. Bad guy. Yeah. Not good. Not well, a good
people
story.
People use it metaphorically.
Yeah, metaphorically
as like, you know, don't be limited by the past. Right. Like, so sacrifice.
The idea, yeah. For those who don't know, the idea is these ships came to this strange foreign land that obviously had native and people here. And instead of giving that group a way to go back or a way to take what they had from where they were and implant it here, the idea would be this visualization of there is no going back. We are going to chart a new path here and see where it goes. The story I was trying to get to is if you try to take your traditional model into the digital world, you're going to sit with a lot of limitations. Now, I'm saying this also as we sit here in a time where that book is almost 10 years old. I still think the fundamentals are true in Control Alt Delete. I think a lot has changed. And by the way, I would make the argument that a lot of the Pollyannic statements I made were definitely dismissed. I mean, we are in a world where it's not we let a thousand flowers bloom. We went from a world of three large entertainment television networks to a world of three large digital networks that are very similarly quite monopolistic. And in fact, they are so much so that if you build an audience on these platforms, you don't even have access to the entire audience. They'll throttle that. You'll have to pay them for access to that audience, which again is very traditional in terms of the model for it. So I don't want to make it sound like there was this visionary thing. I think some of the ideas in there are still true. And again, in a world that has, you know, that one that I should have been paying more attention to back then, but obviously I didn't, that's become much more visible, is we often use these stories, especially ones that are more military-based or colonial-based or just conquering-based, as these analogies that, you know, don't sit well with me. That would be the one part of the book I would completely take out if I could, because you could say it another way. It just had the context at the time of fitting this idea that if you try to take those traditional ways into the new ways, it's going to be challenging. So yeah, how do you reinvent yourself? How do you stick this idea? Yeah,
and I never read it as you were sort of not condoning, but like using it as a literal kind of, I always understood
it. No, it was
You
stupid.
Use it as a metaphor.
It was stupid. You know, I refer to myself now as male, pale, and stale. You know, I'm a middle-aged white guy with a tremendous amount of privilege. I really am. That hit the genetic lottery in terms of that. And I find myself checking myself, thankfully, more and more as I get older, which is healthy. But I didn't back then. And it's problematic because I see how problematic it was. In my own defense, I really came from a place where we're all equal, we're all trying, blah, 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 blah. But it's hard to see your own privilege. I think now our privilege is very much on display.
But Mitch, as your attorney, I would like to take your defense.
Okay.
I would like to take your defense on this one, okay? As a metaphor, okay, and very clearly from the context of the book, the point that you were trying to make. I'm now defending old Mitch, okay?
Okay, please, yeah. Someone should.
The point that you were making is that, you know, with this rapid change in technology that comes in, if you stay sort of too attached to your former way of being, you're going to miss the boat on a lot of things. Yeah. And so you have to master the skill of recreating yourself or like rebooting yourself. That's the terminology you actually use. Recreating and rebooting yourself is this kind of a skill or a mindset that you have to get comfortable with, because with these waves of technological change that are coming at us faster and faster, if you don't get comfortable with that skill and that mindset, it's going to become very problematic to you. And I would argue that your point, that particular point,
for sure,
is even more relevant today in an age of AI, in an age of, you know, genetic technologies. The rate of technological change has not slowed down. It's accelerated, if anything. And so what I wanted to know is, how do you approach this from a practical perspective? And I know you've got a lot of ideas about that in the book, but having, you know, the benefit of perspective over the last 10 years.
Yeah. I can switch from being an apologist to seeing how brilliant that was. Don't worry. I'm pretty good with that. My ego is not that deflated, Fred. The truth of the matter is, you reflect on moments of profound change in your life and you reflect on what got you through it. Who are the voices? Who were the things? With any sense of humility, it is really easy to reflect on some of the technological trends we talked about earlier in the conversation and say, that was totally me. I remember walking down the street not far from here and seeing somebody speaking loudly and thinking they must have a mental health crisis happening, but they were just talking on their phone. I'd never seen that before. Remember when people talking on their phone in a restaurant was rude? Oh, you would 100%. Never do that.
You know what I remember, Mitch? I remember the first selfie I ever saw, and I'm like, oh my God, the narcissism. This is crazy. This is just one person with a mental problem. That's what I thought the first time I saw
and
the selfie.
And now a selfie is essentially a photograph. It's not even a selfie.
Yeah.
So if you can check yourself, as the Beastie Boys so brilliantly said, and look back and go, how many times have I said that is absurd and it became a certainty? that is a really good place to start as an indicator.
So humility.
A little bit. Then I have a close friend, Michael Bungay Stanier, who's wrote some great books, The Coaching Habit and stuff. And I don't think it's his question, but he often will provoke me with this question. He'll say, what has to be true for this to be true? And I just wrote about this really, really recently too, because it is in relation to people saying, oh, AI can never replace X, Y, and Z. Well, what has to be true for that to actually not be true? And if you took and opened up a notebook, a document, and started in bullet point writing what would need to be true for that statement to not be true, you probably would have a very compelling list that would point to many technological changes that already happened. I mean, go back not long, and if I said to you, Fred, you are going to meet your spouse because of a dating app, you'd be like, I would never put my profile. I mean, for people of our age, even doing that still feels a bit humiliating. Versus everybody else, there's no other way to do it. Exactly. It's completely shifted. And for it to be true, the list of what it takes for it to be true are very reasonable and feasible. You know, my punchline to that joke is, once you're done with that list, go ask ChatGPT what has to be true.
Right.
And then see what you're missing. Because it's going to come up with things you didn't even think of. It's going to add to the fact of, you could look at this and go, well, this is, back to Kevin Kelly, a probable inevitable.
I like the ChatGPT as a kind of a sparring partner, as a kind of brainstorming partner.
But again, if you think about reinvention that way, so when people say, oh, you know, we're going to be in a place where one in, I think recently McKinsey came out with a report and they said something like one in 16 people will be replaced in terms of their actual work by 2030. So we're talking like very soon in the grander scheme of things. And I don't look at that and go, oh my God, like, what am I going to do? I better have a plan B for my job. Like, Fred, you need a plan B. AI is going to take you. Like, that's not me. I'm just always wondering, I wonder what my work is going to look like with all of this stuff. So my approach to it is so different. And this is the problem I have with my life, actually. Like, if I'm going to get very personal, I almost can't believe that people don't think like me. Not that I'm such a great thinker, but isn't it obvious that we've all seen this stuff? And you realize that, wow, no, people are really set in their ways. And so I will jokingly be referred to sometimes as a futurist. And I will jokingly say I'm more of a presentist, right? Like, I'm able to look at things that have happened in technology and how they've impacted consumer behavior and make some connections that maybe other people can't see, only because I have more tread on that tire, right?
You remind me of a quote. And I'm going to find the exact attribution, but it's, the future is here. It's just not widely distributed yet.
Yeah, it's not evenly distributed.
Yeah.
I don't know who said that either, but it's somebody related to Wired Magazine, I'm sure.
We'll find that, Google.
But, you know, here's like a pragmatic correlation analogy to that. If you look at how much these investment wealth managers make, who's the number one person out there?
I know that in terms of as an investor.
Buffett. Yeah, it's
Warren
Buffett. As an
investor, Warren Buffett, right. Yeah, would be known as.
Are there people in the past 20 years who have year on year had better returns percentage-wise than Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway? The answer is, oh yeah.
Of course.
By double-digit percentage-wise. So then how come they're not that? And the answer is really simple. He started when he was 13, and compounded interest works that way. Knowledge is compounded interest. So the reason people often can't change is because they haven't spent enough time getting to the place that I am. And what I realize is, through no fault of my own, just a general interest, is I've always liked this stuff. And so when the first computer came out and my parents happened to be able to buy one for, you know, our family, and I wrote a book report on an Atari 800 with a dot matrix printer and brought it in grade 5 or 6 to school and had it sent home with a zero because the teacher looked at it and said, how do I know that you wrote this? Because they couldn't see my handwriting. It's so absurd to think about that now. And if I think about all of these things in my life that have brought me to where I am, it's not me trying to forcefully push my way in. I'm just really open to the fact that I could be wrong, you know?
So you don't put up a defense. You don't put up like you hear this, well, AI is never going to replace what I do, or, well, there's no way it can do this or that. You sort of like, I almost see like step one as being lowering the sort of influence and power of these defense mechanisms, right? And then staying open to, what will emerge, like, so observing, right? Accepting. And then also just taking it on as a creative challenge, right? How can this change what I do and maybe improve it?
Yeah, I don't know how great I am at negotiating. We were talking a little bit about this earlier, but there is a great negotiator, and his name is Herb Cohn, who wrote this book, You Can Negotiate Anything. Anyone who knows anything about negotiation would say, well, there are people like Chris Voss, Never Split the Difference, great book, and there are other great negotiators and salespeople, but Herb Cohn is quite the character. And Herb had this line. I used to speak on stage with him a lot, which is amazing because he's no longer with us, and just his energy was a funny person, much older than I was. Obviously, he could have been my father in terms of age. And Herb used to say, in a negotiation, you have to care. You have to really, really care, but not that much. And I only came to that term later-ish in my career, but it always sits with me in, I really believe this, and I really... But what if, you know, now the problem with that is we then head into conspiracy theories. We then head into partisan thinking. We then head into a world where you could say, well, then I don't believe in anything. And suddenly the earth is flat and science is this. And that's not me, right? It's a tint. It's a hue that you put on your thinking that allows you to go through some type of psychological exercise that enables you to play some form of devil's advocate, but put in more information and data than superfluous analogies or bad information. So you always want to be checking your work and double checking at the end of the day too. I want to use the internet for information, but I want to make sure that I understand the sources of it. This makes people very frustrated because they just want the answer. I don't know that I live in that same world. And then if I go from that futurist to the presentist, what I've also discovered is it's afforded me a career that, you know, most careers are on some type of path, and you can maybe almost even see the end of that path. When you're constantly looking at technology and innovation, you realize that that path never ends, because tomorrow there's something new to look at. And it's not only a very long path, but it's very wide also. I think the challenge is most people's vocation, the path is actually not very wide, and it's not very long. And they're comforted by that limitation. It might make them even insane to be in the world I'm in. But, you know, what's the word? We talked about surprising earlier. The word is curiosity. I'm just really curious, and I'm open for that journey. I'm not an adventurer. I don't like heights. I don't like things that move too fast. I don't even like the outdoors. I think everything outside is trying to kill me. And nature is trying to constantly kill me, whether it's a pandemic, a virus, or a bug, or whatever it is. So I like concrete and air conditioning and commercialized spaces. That's what I like, strong Wi-Fi. And I know that about myself. But at the same time, I am ever curious. And as I get older, I think while I can become very nostalgic, as we talked about earlier, I find my level of curiosity increasing as my comfort with myself gets more in check. I worry less about what people think about me, so I'm able to explore more. It gives me more time to explore everything from different styles of music to different types of books. All of that opens me up to other ideas. Some of the greatest ideas I've ever had have come from a business book or reading Wired magazine. It's come from something I saw in a museum or in Architectural Digest or a piece of content that's not related to my actual work, because then you can create inference and other ideas like that. So, you know, how do you do that is be curious. I think the problem with people is they don't want to be curious because they want more certainty. So anytime that certainty is removed, which by the way is everything, we could both walk out of here and unfortunately have a stroke. I mean, I don't want to think about that. I want to live with this world where if that were to happen, I could say to myself, I really did explore as much as I could versus constantly make my world smaller and smaller. Now, that's really complex in the world because we are living in a world where we have this unlimited potential to connect, 6 pixels of separation, and yet we're becoming so nationalistic and so dug into our ideals and our values and not open to having people with a differing opinion. Some of them can be
is that almost a reaction too? Do you see it as that? Like we opened up the potential for connection so much that there's almost like a return of the tribal, the nationalist, the ideological, those certainties become even more attractive because of the potential for openness and exploration and connection.
I would say that my pessimism, which I am, I'm an optimist with a certain level of pessimism, really amplified during the pandemic, less about technology. Here was a moment in time that we all had to deal with. We all had to go home. We all had to, again, check ourselves. We all had to realize that some people are living in very small apartments with multiple people with a pet and really bad Wi-Fi and are expected to work at the same level as someone who had the privilege that I have, which is insane. And in this moment where globally we all had to do with this, instead of coming together, we frayed even more. Mm. That's where my pessimism is probably peaked, because then what will it take for us to come together if not that? If not a global pandemic, which made us so much more divided, and some people would argue exactly why, and I get that too, I'm not dumb, but it's depressing to me, and it's what makes me very pessimistic that I don't think we can ever come together. If we can't do it then, I don't know when.
It's funny that you should hit me with that, because I've always seen you as such an optimistic person and so exploratory. And my final question was going to be about, you know, the journey forward. And so on this note of like this kind of heightened self-awareness around how things can sort of turn in multiple different directions, yeah, good and bad. We've talked about the optimism that technology brings. You know, we can save lives. We can lower wrongful convictions. Okay. We can create more connectivity. We can do all of that. And yet, as the pandemic showed, we can also sink in, you know, ideological rabbit holes and turn each other into, you know, the enemy and, like, you know, the conservatives versus liberals and the tribal and all of that. So that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it also is these sort of big opposition between life and career, right? Some people are just so dominated by their need to have certainty around their career. And then other people look at it from a broader life perspective. And I know that you've always said you hate the expression work-life balance.
Yeah, I like flow.
Yeah. So, flow. So let's talk about it. So what is perhaps the reinvention, perhaps the next step in the journey for you from a general sort of life perspective? How do you attack this? Maybe the reboot, yeah, of Mitch Joel looking forward. And I was very surprised that you sort of hit me with the pessimism. That's not what I was expecting from you. But with that, including that in your perspective, in your mature perspective at this point, everything you've done, you've already lived through what many people would consider multiple careers.
Right? I have.
So as you look forward and as you approach this next reboot, how do you sort of, what's your mindset? What's your perspective?
Yeah, the pessimism doesn't have a correlation to it. Mm. And what I would say is, from a very young age, I thought about what does success look like? So yeah, financial is a big one. I mean, there's no doubt that if you can remove the financial woes of your life, that is a big one. Is it as big as your health? Is it as big as your physical health, your mental health? Is it as big or powerful as the relationships that you have? Is it as big and powerful as the balance that you create between what are happier or sadder moments in a world that Susan Cain so beautifully brings forward in her new book, Bittersweet? You need to have a bit of that mix. Very, very normal and common. So there's different things that I would equate to success or even general wealth, which are not necessarily financially based. So if you're living in a world where your construct is purely financial, which most people probably are, 100%, it's hard to understand what I'm about to say. So what I'll say is remove yourself from a world where everything is driven by success equals once I have my finances in order, I can, then, will, should. I think all of us have the chance to move from a place where we are extracting to contributing. So you see this with extremely wealthy people who have either don't have to work or have retired. They extracted. Bill Gates would be a great example of this, actually. Bill Gates extracted quite a bit and now is contributing at scale, whether you like him or not, whether you think he's implanting chips into your body,
we won't get into the conspiracy
whether you think
theories.
He's, you know, curing polio, whatever it might be. I think the balance should always be in your life, that whatever you're extracting in terms of your work, your salary, what you need from, you are also contributing in a way. When I look back on my career, very early days of Twist Image, which was the marketing agency, which is how we met, because two of my business partners are friends of yours, or one of them in particular is a close friend of yours, there was an article written about me because I was very involved in community. And I always felt that for community to work, it has to be local, national, and international. You have to have your hands in all three if you can. I was doing this when I had no money. And when I mean no money, there was an adult that had to co-sign for my apartment at that time. I could not make rent without having somebody co-sign. That's where I was financially. Very small apartment that was a fight for me to pay my monthly rent on. Forget, you know, cars and having disposable income. I would get invitations to weddings for friends at that point in their lives. And I'd be like, how could they invite me? I don't have money to buy them a present. That's how I was thinking. Mm. Like, how dare you? And, you know, it's how but I was still contributing. What I would hope for the world and moving forward is you get to a point that as you get older, and it doesn't take much financially to get you across that line, which is another longer conversation, that you start moving from a place of extraction to more contribution. Now, what you will learn, I think, and I'm not that old, is the more that I contribute, I'll use the word easier it is to extract, but I mean it in the sense of it doesn't become as burdensome that I have to extract. I can't give to anything or can't give my time, my money, anything because I'm so busy extracting, trying to just get by. I don't believe that to be a truism in my life. I just don't. And by having that now, I believe I'm just expanding the contribution side. So if I look at my brand new business, which again, you know, it's called Thinkers One, what it really is ultimately a way for every business to be able to affordably buy bite-sized and personalized thought leadership from some of the best thinkers in the world. So for the thought leaders, what I'm trying to do is, I believe most of us are leaving a lot of money on the table in a world of hybrid and virtual work. Why not bring someone that you would only see at your keynote every year into your everyday meetings? So one is, there's a way to help them grow their business and grow the people who are going to be able to hear and benefit from their ideas. Mm-hmm. A nonprofit, a small business startup that can't afford even to hire a keynote speaker for their event can now get a taste of that. So that's one side. On the other side, what I believe is happening is that I'm now making it affordable to those types of businesses by fractionalizing it and creating it in an e-commerce way. I'm not trying to promote the business, but it speaks to this. It's a business, I believe, that contributes more to so many individuals and businesses than it is extracts. I do believe that the idea is big enough that it might create much more extraction for me financially, which is fine. But the thesis of it is based on contribution, not extraction. Mm-hmm. I'm not just trying to get a better price than you and compete with you on price. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to affect change, and there's a social component to it. I believe that's how you reinvent. You start thinking more about how is the work that you're doing contributing mm-hmm. to making things better? And if it's not, what are you doing to do that? And by that, I'm not saying the extraction part takes care of itself. I can't say that because people have really challenged and marginalized lives and problems in the world. But that would be my current strategy. So how do I overweight on the contribution versus extraction?
So it's almost think like, how do you bring more value in a human community?
Yeah.
And then as that value gets created, you have all these options. You can either stay in that modality, you can decide to go more on a business side, but value is always good, right?
If you could grow this practice by being the best green lawyer in Montreal or Canada. It might take you longer than having all those, you know, big walleted corporate clients, but you might be able to grow the business more significantly because of the specialization. At the same time, you're adding value to it. At the same time, that might get you involved in some non-for-profits or have you build a foundation of your own once you have some level of success. These are powerful changes that we all have the ability to do. There's nothing stopping anybody right now, regardless of your income level, to go and serve meals to people who are less fortunate than you. There's nothing stopping you. That is a form of contribution as well. So I think about that. I even think about in the content I create, it's not this holistic, I'm changing the world. But I do believe that if someone listened to the conversation I just had with Dan Pink as an example, it might put them on a path. And that's pure contribution because, yes, I have financially benefited from the podcast, but indirectly, not directly from it.
Mm, love it. Mitch, you've contributed a lot in my life. You've given me advice, support. I've seen you create value in this human community that we've shared bits and pieces of over the years for decades now. And it's kind of heartwarming, but at the same time also, I know that this, when we talk about contribution, you're also kind of mixing it with your very innovative, creative side. And so you're creating value in a very, there's the philanthropy that I know you've been involved in, but there's also like creating value in a human community through innovation and through creativity as well. And I'm not surprised, and I'm loving that that's the focus for you and that's the emphasis moving forward. And I want to thank you for this conversation. I've learned a ton. It was dizzying at times because the and perspective that you keep talking about, or the with perspective, the way you put it, it's very hard to hold these opposites at the same time.
Yeah, F. Scott Fitzgerald, one of the things I end my keynote presentation on is F. Scott Fitzgerald has this idea, right? So, and it works really well in this moment in time. We're going back to hybrid, it's going to be virtual. We're just talking about that here for your business as well. And F. Scott Fitzgerald, who lived long before the internet, said, you know, the real sign of brilliance is your ability to hold two opposing ideas in your mind at the same time and still have the ability to function. I'm paraphrasing. Mm. And I think about that quote all the time. What would have to be true for this to work? And the truth is, can you build what you're doing in a world that is hybrid, in a world that is virtual, or a world that is back to the way things were? And if the answer is that model works there, it's probably a healthier avenue to take. So yeah, I appreciate the time here, and I'm even happy for you to extract from me as being our lawyer and being connected, because I feel like it works for me, because there's a value that works. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the ultimate win, is when you feel there's a contribution and the extraction at the same time. People say in real estate, what's the line? It's a good deal when both parties feel like they didn't get what they wanted.
Yeah.
I don't think that has to be true. I think right. Both parties can feel that they got what they wanted, whether someone paid more, but they felt the contribution on the other side. I have no issue with that.
Yeah, mutual value creation, I think, is like the modality for relationships. Yeah. So when we want it to be a win-win, we want, you know, you can create value in certain ways. I can create value in different ways. And ideally, as a human community, we all show up with that spirit of contribution. And then everybody's uniqueness and everybody's own life experience and everybody's skills and strengths and abilities kind of come together, and we're all creating value for each other. And there's sometimes a tragedy of the commons when we each focus on what's the most that I can personally extract, the community ends up losing. And if we all show up with a spirit of contribution, everybody kind of wins. But it's something that, you know, you've got to promote in a human community and hope that people show up. And, you know, as I've gotten older as well, I've kind of started to kind of ascertain, you know, what people's motivations are. And I find it's a lot easier to create value for people that show up in a spirit of contribution as well.
Yeah, look, you ultimately want, you know, again, you go back to someone like Jeffrey Gitomer, who's like the ultimate salesperson. People, you know, all things being equal, people want to do business with those they know, like, and trust. Mm-hmm. All things being unequal, people will want to do business with people they know, like, and trust. Meaning, I'm willing to pay more if I know, like, and trust you. And if that isn't a message that resonates and that builds community, yeah, I don't know what is. Mm.
I love that we're ending on this really philosophical human fundamental
that doesn't change
with time, doesn't change with technology. We go back to the essentials, the fundamentals. If you focus on that, on creating value for people, being trustworthy, being pro-social, doing good in the world, you tend to kind of, right? You tend to kind of figure it out.
You find your pace.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Mitch, thank you so much for this. We'll have to do it again.
Anytime. Happy to be here.
Love it. Thank you.